Like I passed through a thousand deserts and come upon a mountain stream. I was blind for a thousand sunsets, then opened my eyes to see.
This is Guilty, written by Lua, performed by Mistborn Hero. A Magnus Archives Put Together project with additional tags, breakup, minor character death, angst, alternate universe, time travel, canon typical violence, not a fix it, survivor guilt, anxiety, smoking, grief and mourning. The apocalypse happens.
Send to me a sparrow, show a little flame, anything to help you make it.
Summary. These days, things are different. These days, things are exactly the same. One way or another, John watches.
But there's a desert in between. I'm tracking a trail of petals. The night, it is alive. The wind keeps twisting and turning, but somehow I will arrive.
These days, they pass in a blur of too much smoke and the voices of dead people on loop. It is not an attempt at anything. It is simply grief. It is the end of the world, and these days, John's grief has a seat at the metaphorical table. Are you going to die? Asks quietly Elias's, Jonah's, all too familiar voice that still echoes through his mind. I am not, John replies, and smokes cigarette after cigarette until his mouth tastes like bitter coffee. Are you quite sure? That annoying voice insists, and John is not sure at all, but he lies through his teeth to the empty room, to the voice in his mind, to himself, and to no one in particular. I'm not, John replies, and turns the volume all the way up so those dead voices end up a little distorted with the static. These days, they pass in a blur of nothing followed by nothing followed by nothing followed by sheer despair. John has lost count of the days since the end of the world. It's unhealthy, Martin had said, but John doesn't remember how long ago it was since they had seen each other. It is unhealthy, he agrees, but it feels fitting that he should be the one to keep track after what he did. He doesn't, though. You didn't do anything, Martin had said then, but that had been a bold-faced lie. It was Elias. It was Elias. It was Elias. It was Elias. It was Jonah, Magnus. It was Jonah through Elias, through John. It was John. It was just John in his hunger. It was just John with his own voice. It was John and his scars. It was John's voice, John's choices, John's scars, John's body. It was John. Fully, undoubtedly, not by his choice, no, but John, even so. This is a path of self-destruction, Martin tells him at some point while they hold each other in an attempt at comfort or safety or love. It is cold. John feels held by a stranger, and he doesn't want to tell Martin such things because it isn't his fault. It is John who became something else. It is John who cannot reach him. All of it is John's fault, and these days, John's been drowning in guilt and plain air. Martin doesn't care about that reasoning. He tries to reassures John. He comforts him. He holds on just as tight and just as desperate. But he didn't doom the world, did he? So how can it be the same? John pulls back. I know, he says, and these days, John knows more than he would ever wish for. It's not your fault, Martin insists, and John tries to hold onto him, but he is drowning, and he can only hold his breath for so long. John holds Martin's hands and doesn't look at him. He wants to beg for forgiveness from the person he loves. He doesn't. John caresses the back of Martin's hands, and he wants to ask him for anger, for violence, or anything that acknowledges John's part in all of this. John is desperate to be found guilty. He can't stand the idea of being simply a puppet. He couldn't be a monster at all because he's barely a person as it is. Each step of his way was decided for him. Every choice was a lie. Every feeling was simply an unintentional side effect. John needs anger. John needs guilt. And he could understand those. It is the end of the world, and it has to be his fault. I'm guilty, he wants to say, and he is so very afraid that when he does say so, he will be denied everything. Humanity. Freedom. That's what John is clinging to so desperately, despite the fact he knows he isn't human anymore. These days, they pass in broken conversations full of fear and as much love as they can hold to. John listens to the tapes again and again and again and again. John is drowning and his pleas fall on the wrong ears. Martin denies his guilt. It is the end of the world, and Martin shushes him and holds him and denies his guilt altogether. It's fine, he says. We'll find a way, he promises. And John pulls away again and again and again and again. He is starting to forget how to breathe. The cabin is happy. The growing resentment isolates them, and the cabin is happy. John pushes him away. He shuts himself off in a room and listens to the tapes Elias, Jonah, had sent him. These days, they pass in a blur of too much smoke and the voices of dead people on a loop. John lights up a cigarette with shaky hands. These days, he never runs out of cigarettes. They bring no pleasure with them, but it gives him something to do. These days, they pass in a blur of desperation and the loneliness and hunger. This is a path of self-destruction. Martin's voice still echoes through the room. He doesn't know how long it's been since he has last seen Martin. The cabin is happy about it. John knows so. It is the end of the world, and everything feels wrong. The cabin is happy. The cabin is happy. John isn't happy. Martin isn't happy. And that feeds the cabin. The cabin is hungry. The cabin is greedy, and it wants more. It wants them to stay and be miserable and isolated and clinging to the ghost of each other forever. The cabin is hungry. John is hungry. He closes his eyes. He doesn't fall asleep because he doesn't need to. This is a changed world. John wants the cabin gone. Are you sure? Someone, something asks, and that voiceless echo rings through his mind. I could do that for you, it promises. No, John replies. I'm not ready, he justifies. I may never be ready, he hopes. John lies down on the floor, letting his cigarette burn out without smoking it. It goes out and doesn't burn him. John stares at the ceiling. Are you trying to die? Mocks way too often the all too familiar voice of the last person he wants to think about these days. It is a voice that sticks to his thoughts, a persistent sound on the back of his mind that he can't seem to get rid of. He turns the volume all the way up when that happens. It doesn't matter how dead anyone on those tapes are by now, because they still save him. These days, John feels like he's been drowning for a really long time, and maybe he should just accept that. It is grief and guilt and terror and hunger and everything out there that is simply yelling and hurting and crying and begging and demanding that he take a look. And John wants to cling to Martin like a lifeboat, but every time he tries to reach for him, he misses his mark and sinks even further. The world ended, changed, and John knows it is not okay. There is no way it could be. He can hear it. He can feel it. The horror outside their window calls to him. The world ended, changed by John's hands through his body, and Martin tells him it's okay. It is not his fault. It never was. It could never be. And John cries in his arms because it is, it was, and it would never stop being. It was his call. In the end, he opened the door. The sky looked back, and there is no going back from that. When Martin finally gives up, the argument that follows is soft in places it doesn't have edges, and kind in all the wrong ways. There is no going back from that, either. Martin leaves. John stays. The cabin isn't happy anymore. These days, the words find John on their own, and they fall from his lips like he's sick, and maybe he is. He doesn't have to ask the right questions. He doesn't have to beg for information. These days, John knows other people's fears better than anything. It runs through him. It comes out of his mouth. He puts it into words. He shapes them into statements. These days, John closes the curtain and he tries really hard not to watch. It is the end of the world, and the watching calls to him, but he doesn't want to heed the call, not yet. When John finally gives up, the decision that follows is lighter than expected and bitter in all the right ways. John gets up, grabs his cigarettes, and gets out with no intention of ever going back. John leaves. He leaves, and the world that is waiting for him is almost overwhelming. These days, they pass in a blur of fear, followed by fear, followed by fear, followed by sheer despair, and it feels good to collect the statements. John has lost count of the statements that have found him since the end of the world. "It is unhealthy," Martin's voice echoes through John's mind. John doesn't remember how long ago it was since they have seen each other. "It is unhealthy," he agrees, "but it feels fitting that he should be the one to keep track after what he did. It feels so good to do so."
"You have learned to watch,"
Elias's, Jonah's, all-too-familiar voice points out to him every time John comes back to. These days, they pass in a blur of horrible things and a strange, tentative pleasure that insists to come through it. There is no sugarcoating it, because it is the end of the world, and these days, terror is everywhere, and John has to come to accept he feeds on it. Still, he insists,
"I haven't."
The blatant lie makes him ashamed.
"Are you quite sure, Archivist?"
Jude Perry's annoying voice insists, and for a second there, John misses Elias, Jonah's voice. John wants to argue hypotheticals with the voices living on his head. He wants to argue that he doesn't enjoy the statements. Lie. That he knows what he's doing. Lie. That things could be different if he could figure it out. Lie. That his own choices would have been different. Lie? "Are you sure?" Someone, something asks, and that voiceless echo rings through his mind. "I could do that for you," it promises, and it follows through, and John finds himself in a busy street, staring at Jude Perry. It takes a moment before he realizes she is speaking to him. Even then, the words don't actually register, nor does the noise of everyday life going on around him. Where is he? John
blinks, and the overwhelming, blinding, terrifying, blinding pain that follows that small action is so intense that John almost pukes right then and there. Whatever Jude Perry is saying is irrelevant now, and John knows so. He stumbles a step back and the world spins around him. John blinks again. The headache all the worse every time he does so. His vision blurs around the edges and his stomach turns. John knows too much, far too much. He knows in a way he hadn't experienced before. At that time, he knows things he hadn't even wondered about yet. He knows more than he ever should have known back then. John already knows that Jude Perry will mark him. John already knows that pain, that scar, that fear. And it makes him so angry. It takes effort to look at Jude Perry, and when he does, she is watching him with barely disguised interest in knowing if her god somehow caused this through her. She thinks she knows his fear, but she doesn't know enough. She doesn't understand it. Despite all the ways she is wrong about the version of John standing in front of her now, her interest hits him with such intensity that John finds himself reciting it back to her. He focuses on Jude Perry, and the world stops spinning. He's found a subject, a statement, and John watches her as the words, the knowledge, pour out from his own mouth. He doesn't mean to do it, he doesn't want to do it, but still, it comes naturally to him. He pulls the statement from her, like it is the end of the world, and it is not, not anymore, not yet. And Jude Perry catches on to what is happening much faster than John himself does, but her words, her threats, barely reach him now. There is only one fear, her fear. And John wants to take it in, to feed on it, to feed her to his own god, ceaseless watcher, and to simply watch her struggling. But he doesn't do it. Instead, John reaches out and grabs Jude Perry's hand, and he looks her in the eye as she burns his hand. He still hasn't stopped. Shut up! He keeps on talking and talking and talking, and the pain is irrelevant because she is terrified of him, of what he knows, of what he's doing, of not knowing. And he knows this then, and he already knew this pain, and he isn't scared. He is just so angry. Jude Perry no longer scares him. He isn't afraid of her. He already knows so much, and he is just so angry at her. On behalf of all of her victims, on behalf of himself, on behalf of the world she helped destroy, on behalf of himself, he is just so angry. He is just so angry, and he wants revenge. He wants to eat her fear up until there is nothing left of her. and he wants her to pay for everything, even if it isn't solely her fault. John doesn't let go of her hand. It hurts. That scares him. John doesn't stop looking into her eyes. It scares her. And that scares him too. Jude Perry says something, and fear runs through John's veins in a way that it had never done before the end of the world. She recognizes it for what it is, and she knows he is enjoying her terror. She knows he is feeding her to his god, ceaseless watcher. She knows this is not the same person who came searching for her crumbs of knowledge, and she knows danger when he looks into her eyes and holds her hand and doesn't listen to her words. And she knows all of that because John wants her to know. He wants her to know what he is. He wants her to know what is coming. The stream of information makes it hard to focus on anything but her fear and his anger, and then he realizes what she already knows. He wants to kill her. She tries to pull her hand away almost in the same second realization hits him. It doesn't really matter, not anymore, because John calls upon the ceaseless watcher, and the ceaseless watcher answers him. It happens then and there, and John finds himself standing in a busy street, suddenly aware of too much, of his surroundings, of his actions, of his powers. He feels watched. He feels seen. People are watching him. The eye is watching him. He doesn't understand. Without any planned direction or purpose, he runs. He runs because he can't stay there being watched, being seen by those confused bystanders who don't understand what they had just witnessed, who are scared and tempting in ways that people, regular people, shouldn't be. He runs because he wants to reach into those minds and pull out their fear, their horror, their confusion at what just happened and let it, their statements, run through his body like pleasure. He runs, and it isn't until much later that John realizes he is out of place. When is he? What day is it? Knowledge he shouldn't have yet clicks into place, and John knows where and when and what he is. He knows the version of him he is right now isn't the version of him he should have been. He has already seen the world end, and it hasn't happened yet. He looks up and watches his own reflection in the mirror. There are bandages and other emergency supplies all over the sink. This isn't the best hotel John has seen, but it is not the worst either. Maybe I'm losing it, John whispers to himself. Are you sure about that, archivist? Michael's voice mocks him in his own thoughts. John already knows the answer, but he pretends that he doesn't. He has had an ongoing headache since Jude Perry happened. He could be losing it. He isn't, though. John watches himself in the mirror. He looks just the same as he looked back at that time. He looks less scared, less confused. Well, maybe he doesn't look exactly the same. The scar on his hand is shaped a little differently. Oh, he changed his past. In fact, he changed a lot of people's past. He wonders if any of those people from the street will seek out the Institute to talk about what they saw, about John. He wonders if anyone at the Institute
will realize it is John at all.
But do you want them to know?
Elias's voice asks him, and his own hesitation makes John so ashamed that he lies out loud.
No.
John closes his eyes, and he tries to imagine Elias dead. Could he do it? He tries to picture himself standing by his body. He sees it in his mind. There is blood on the floor. There is blood on his hands. He sees the knife, the blood, the body on the ground, Elias's body. John looks down at his own hands. There is no blood. Could he really do it? He closes his eyes again, and he pictures himself stabbing Elias, saving the world. He pictures the knife. He sees his own scarred hands holding the knife. He sees his own bloody scarred hands holding the bloody knife. He sees Jonah's eyes, Elias's face, Elias's blood, Elias's lifeless body, and Jonah's eyes. He pictures the knife. He pictures himself stabbing him. He pictures him dead. Finally dead. Could he do it, though? It is an easy answer. It is such an easy choice. Kill Jonah, kill Elias, and take his place. John's breath catches on his throat. He opens his eyes and stares at himself in the mirror. It is an easy choice. Is it? He doesn't know what to do. It is the right path to take. Is it? And still, he hesitates. He doesn't know if Jonah's death would change anything. He doesn't know. He doesn't know. And that is the problem.
The problem is you, isn't it, archivist?
Mike's crew voice asks him in a polite tone. Jonah's death is the solution. A solution. It is an easy decision. It is a decision that would save everyone. He owes it to them, dead or alive, to hope he can change things. He owes it to them, dead and alive, to try. It is an easy choice. Do it. And he can't. He can't. He won't. He doesn't know. John feels an absurd urge to seek out Michael Crew, to let things play out as they did, as they should, to do nothing at all but watch, to not try at all, to not change anything at all. He can't, he can't, he can't, he can't, he shouldn't, and yet he wants to. He decides to go for a smoke instead. Later on, when John finds himself knocking on Michael Crew's door, it is odd and easy, and it feels like it shouldn't be, despite knowing where this could lead, where it did lead, despite having already lived through it, despite knowing better. He still finds himself knocking on Michael Crew's door, and it's as easy as saving everyone should be. But this is not saving anyone. It is his choice, and an easy one, and he doesn't understand it. It is his choice. He knows the outcome. He should know better. He should do better. And he doesn't. This is John. This is the approaching end of the world, and it is all John's fault. It is John's choice. It is all John. Was it always?
This is a path to self-destruction, says the echo of Martin's voice. Why do you want to take the world down with you?
And even then, it is still easy, like the only possible decision ahead. It is like muscle memory. It is easy, like nothing else.
You are ready.
Elias's voice rings through his mind with such pleasure in his voice that it sends a chill down Jan's spine. I am not, Jan insists, and still knocks on Mike Crew's door. Things go more or less as expected. Things go more or less as they did before. Mike Crew, Daisy, Basira. It is like ticking off events in a checklist. Jan watches, knowing what is supposed to happen before it does. Jan watches and watches, taking it all in and fighting the urge to blurt out statements that were never voluntarily given to him. Fear runs through his body. It is their fear. It is intense and amazing, and it overshadows John's own fears most of the time. These days, John knows too much, and he watches too much, and hope is becoming such a heavy burden to carry. These days, John smokes too much, and lets fear run through his body too often. The apocalypse hasn't happened yet, but it will, how could it not?
You have finally learned to watch,
Elias's Jonah's voice accuses him.
Don't lie, I know.
These days pass in a blur of knowing and not understanding and smoking and waiting and losing people. These days, John is guilty, guiltier, and the apocalypse hasn't happened yet. The end. Thank you for listening. This has been such a great project. Lua is a fantastic partner, and I really love the story she wrote, and reading it was very fun. I enjoyed the repetition because it allowed me to like go this, and it was like fun reading like that. And also then I got to do tiny sound effects with voices to make them sound far away and in Jan's thoughts. And that's always fun because I really love doing sound effects, okay? So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed. And goodbye.